Penguin Random House Audio presents Lady in Red, An Intimate Portrait of Nancy Reagan by Sheila Tate. Read for you by Kimberly Farr. Foreword. Nancy Reagan was truly one of the most loyal and protective spouses I have ever met in my 93 years. My dear friend Ronald Reagan could not have asked for a better partner. No matter the issue, politics, world affairs, inside White House gamesmanship, Nancy had his back. She and I tangled a time or two, and she could be a complicated person. But I always knew, even when we disagreed, that her motives were pure. It was never about her. It was about her beloved Ronnie. And for that, she had my utmost respect. President George H.W. Bush, April 20th, 2017. Introduction. One of the hardest things I ever had to do was to tell Nancy Reagan I was leaving the White House. After working for her for more than 4 years as her press secretary, I reluctantly decided it was time to leave government service and to return to a more normal life, if that's the right way to describe the public relations business. My government service over those 4 years had involved so much sacrifice and inconvenience, not for me, for my husband and children. Because my schedule as press secretary was subject to change at a moment's notice, we, my husband and I, realized that for 4 years we had never been able to entertain our friends. I missed many of my children's school activities, but they missed their mother being at home at night, making dinner and talking over the day. It felt like the right time to say goodbye. Still, it was difficult to give the news to the First Lady, with whom I had worked so closely and whom I had come to know and admire greatly. We were standing in the middle of the private living room in the residence when I blurted out my news with tears in my eyes. I told her how much it hurt to leave. "Thank you, Mrs. Reagan," I said, "for allowing me the honor of working for you." She walked up next to me and hugged me. We talked for a while, and she suggested it was high time I started calling her Nancy. I would do so for the next 30 years. The story of how I came to be Nancy Reagan's White House press secretary is one of happenstance, Irish luck, and a well-connected boss. I grew up in the Virginia suburbs of Washington, the second of five children. My dad was a communications attorney in D.C. My mother was a traditional homemaker. In 1960, after graduating from Falls Church High, I was off to college at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, where I majored in journalism, the Who, What, When, Where, and Why School of Journalism, and then began my career working at various public relations agencies. That was work I loved. I married and divorced. By 1979, I was back in Falls Church with two wonderful children, ages 6 and 9. 2 years later, two major developments changed my life. I married a wonderful fellow named Bill Tate, and Nancy Reagan gave me a job. Bob Gray headed up the Hill and Knowlton, Washington office, where I worked. He became communications director of the Reagan-Bush campaign, taking several staff members with him to join the effort, while I stayed behind to run a large portion of our business. The only political work I did was early in the primaries, when I made evening calls as a volunteer at the phone bank, asking for donations to Texas Governor John Connally's campaign for the presidency. After Ronald Reagan won the election in 1980, Bob Gray called and asked me to send him a copy of my resume. He was aware of a position for which he felt I was well qualified. He said he couldn't tell me what it was, but that it was right up my alley. The next thing I knew, within hours, I was asked to be at Blair House that evening at 6 p.m. I had walked by Blair House, the official White House guest house, too many times to count, but had never been inside. It was, and is, on Pennsylvania Avenue, across the street from the White House. In between that call and my arrival, I got dressed in a navy blue suit and realized that the only nice heels I had were a mess. Off to the shoe repair shop, where I begged the repairman to shine them while I waited. When I checked in with the receptionist at Blair House, she motioned for me to sit down and told me someone would come for me shortly. I began noticing people I'd just seen on television walking through that room: General Alexander Haig, who had been appointed Secretary of State, and National Security Advisor Dick Allen. The room itself was a lovely old-fashioned parlor, and I started thinking about how this house had functioned as the White House for a period of time when Harry Truman was president, while he was having the now famous Truman balcony installed on the south side of the White House, and the attempt on his life while he was there. After a wait of about 15 minutes, Peter McCoy, Nancy's first and, by my measure, best chief of staff, came out to meet me, introduced himself, and ushered me upstairs to a second-floor room. I had figured out the potential job must be the press secretary job by the time I met Nancy. Bob Gray had told me that I would be meeting Nancy Reagan and that the job was in the East Wing. I had read the negative press coverage she received about wanting the Carters to move out of the White House early, capped off by a story that she slept with a tiny little gun when Ronnie was out of town. I remember wondering if this would be an impossible job. There she was, Nancy Reagan, in real life, standing waiting for me. She was, I recall, wearing a green wool dress. After greeting me, she said, "I have been looking forward to meeting you after reading your resume." I said, "I am thrilled to be here and to have the chance to meet you in person." We sat and managed to have a good discussion. I kept my shaky hands under my legs for most of the meeting, and she told me then she wanted to find a way to become involved in the youth drug abuse issue. She asked me to tell her about my experience and the clients I'd had. As I look back on that meeting, which lasted less than an hour, I would describe her as reserved. I could tell she was listening carefully to whatever I said and evaluating me. I do remember wondering if drug abuse was the right issue for her. I thought perhaps it was too dark for a first lady. What drew her to this cause? And wondering whether she could have any credibility in discussing it. Had she ever confronted drug abuse in her own family? I wanted to ask her so many questions, but I held my tongue. As I took my leave, I said to her, "Mrs. Reagan, it has been a pleasure to meet you, and if I can do anything for this exciting new administration, I would be honored." She smiled and simply said, "Thank you so much for coming." She pointedly never mentioned exactly what job she was talking with me about, which really confused me. I left wondering why we didn't get down to brass tacks. I assumed my chances for the job were slim, not having worked on the Reagan campaign. So I was pleasantly surprised when Peter McCoy followed up and asked me to meet with a few other people. And I learned the reason for the lack of specificity in my conversation with Nancy. She had initially hired a society reporter, Robin Orr, from California, to be her press secretary. It was not a good fit. When Nancy realized she needed someone who was more familiar with politics and the D.C. press, she had decided to replace her. She had not yet notified Robin and didn't want her to find out about her replacement without advance notice. On the other hand, she knew it was important to have a successor lined up before the news broke. The following week, at her request, I met individually with Mike Deaver, the much-heralded Reagan.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?